happen.
We have, what, 8 bills, it looks like, on the agenda. And I'm going to announce now that we're not going to meet this evening. So if anything doesn't get done at this meeting, we will move it to Thursday's meeting, because the only thing we have up on Thursday are liquor bills. I want to tell people that I have no intention of bringing the wine with dinner forward at that meeting, so it should move quickly and smoothly, just in case anybody thought I had a hidden agenda. So, anyway, we will start with Senator Day and Senate File 1825. Welcome to our Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee, Senator Day.
Madam Chairman, it's good to be with you. I used to be on this committee. I enjoyed it, and sorry I'm not on it anymore. Today I'm here to with a bill on the Boxing Commission, and with me is Scott Ledoux. And as people know or don't know, Scott Ledoux is a very accomplished professional fighter. Fought Muhammad Ali, Larry Holmes, Ken Norton, I don't know, a whole bunch of heavyweights. But anyway, I think he was a heavyweight back then. But we do have one change that we would like to do, and that's in Subdivision 3, where it talks about the mixed martial arts. We want to pull that out of the bill.
Senator Day, is that on page 1?
That is on
Section
page
2,
1.
Sub
it would
3.
Be line like 1.16.
And you would just
we would like to delete that. We're our boxing commission, and we've had very good luck. We Mr. Ledoux went around and got this thing up and running, we've had 5 major boxing matches in Minneapolis and Rochester. We've had upwards of 10,000 people at one of them, and from 4,000 to 7,000 at the other 4. And it's been very, very successful. But there are some things that in that we're one of the few boxing commissions that works off of fees and whatever. We did want to make some changes to our structure as fees. And at this time,
well, Senator Day, let's get the bill in the form you'd like it to be. So Senator Johnson would move. Then on line 1.16, delete mixed martial arts only.
Right.
So it will read,
Chair.
Then all mixed martial arts, no, excuse me, all ultimate fight contests and similar sporting events are subject to this chapter. Is that how it?
We'll get rid of the whole thing.
Or do you want to just delete that whole section 2?
Madam Chair, just delete that whole 2 paragraphs.
All of section 2.
Right, yeah.
Okay, Senator Johnson moves on page 1, delete section 2. All 4 lines of it, and then obviously renumber the other sections. Any discussion? That's an author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails.
Madam Chairman, thank you, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Ledoux.
Welcome, Mr. Ledoux.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it, the opportunity to come here. We're just changing some regulatory things, like licenses, license fees, trying to raise some funds to keep the Boxing Commission going. As Mr. Day said, we've had tremendous amount of success with our 4 or 5 shows that we've had. We've had a tremendous amount. We had almost 10,000 people at the Target Center in December. We had just had a show Friday where we had 6,000 people, which also was on Showtime. We have another show coming up at Roy Wilkins, which will be on the 25th, which will be on ESPN2. And it's just exciting that boxing is back in Minnesota, and we've really had an exciting time keeping the fights going and having the crowds come. And I just think that it's a great opportunity for Minnesota. As we always say, I tell people, why wouldn't you live in Minnesota? We have a quality of life that's beyond belief. In the summer, we get to go to our lake homes and up to the north to fish and camp out and do stuff like that. And in the wintertime, we get to go to the Guthrie Theater. We get to go to so many venues and entertainment value in the state. It's just unbelievable. And now we have boxing back again, which is really obviously a very well-needed thing. And the commission is very excited about having these fights and having these great contests, so and having great crowds. And
Mr.
along
LeDoux,
with that, we would like to raise a fee, a $1,500 event fee for the promoter. At this time, the commission charges $400 for a promoter's license, and then we would like to have an event fee there for each fight, each contest that they do for an event fee of $1,500. In the past, as I testified last year, they were spending well over $2,000 to have a commission come in and pay for a commissioner for all his expenses and all of his travel and food, and they were spending well over $2,000 at that time to put a show on. And so now we have an opportunity to, we can raise the event fee and show that, and the promoters will recognize that that is not a big issue that's going to stop them from promoting fights. And that's one of the issues. And so we'd like to raise that.
Senator Day, will this probably have to go to finance, right?
Somebody mentioned, it sure will.
Yeah.
But it also has to, Madam Chair, whatever committee that Senator Tomasoni is ahead would like to have it.
Okay,
what we'll do is it'll go to the...
I didn't see him here, but whatever he's ahead of, he'd like to go
well,
there.
That's the economic development budget division, but we just sent it to the finance full finance committee, and then it gets referred to him.
Oh, okay.
So, that I did want to ask Mr. LeDoux, how long was boxing gone?
In 2001, Governor Ventura shut it down. And as you remember, Mr. Ventura enjoyed sports that weren't real. So,
well, Mr. LeDoux, when you called it a show, and I understand. I was thinking, well, no, I know these things are real. These guys are really hitting each other.
Yes, they are.
Yes, they are.
And Ventura didn't like that kind of stuff, so he shut it down. And that was 2001.
Okay.
And it was shut down for 5 years, and it, consequently, it got to a point where they would not allow commissions to come in here anymore to oversee the fights because of the rule infractions and so many issues and injury, and that's one of the reasons for the Boxing Commission. 46 other states have funded commissions, so it's pretty important. It's a great sport, and we need some oversight.
Is there anybody else who would like to testify on this? Anyone in the audience that would like to speak to this bill for or against it? Is there any discussion among members or questions? Then Senator Johnson, did you want to move that Senate File 1825 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Finance Committee? On that motion, any discussion by members? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time. I know you got a busy schedule.
Well, Mr. LeDoux, thank you for your endorsement of life in Minnesota, too. I agree with you. Senator Higgins, you have a couple of bills. We'll do 1677 first. That's... Senator Higgins, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1677 deals with registering people who do hair braiding. You might often see both men and women with either their own hair or artificial braids, and they were once included in the cosmetology statutes and are no longer. Mr. Hurst is here to walk you through the bill, and I know that I would like to, if somebody would move this as an amendment, on 1.9, take off the word annually.
So it would be a one-time registration?
Yes, ma'am.
Senator Higgins. Senator Metzen?
I'll move
would
this.
Move to on line 1.9, delete the word annually. discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Okay, Senator Higgins.
Mr. Hurst.
Welcome, Mr. Hurst.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Hurst. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Salon and Professional Spa Association, formerly known as the Minnesota chapter of the National Cosmetology Association. We are bringing forth this bill to you today primarily in response to a class action lawsuit that occurred 2 years ago. 2 years ago, there was a class action lawsuit brought against the state of Minnesota seeking to deregulate hair braiding in its entirety. While I won't get into the overall merits of that lawsuit, the state of Minnesota did agree to settle out of court and did agree to completely deregulate this aspect of cosmetology. While I do agree with the plaintiffs that brought forth that lawsuit that the requirements for hair braiders were a bit excessive in that they had to take 1,550 hours of class and curriculum in order to get a cosmetology license in order to do hair braiding. But the result was a complete deregulation, so the pendulum pretty much swung from one extreme to the other. What is proposed in Senate File 1677 is a registration in lieu of licensure of those individuals who practice this as a profession. And I should be clear that this does not pertain to those individuals who might do it for the neighbor or for a sibling in the family. Rather, this is for those who do this in a professional manner. What it seeks to do is to require registration, and registration is contingent solely upon completing no more than 30 hours of education pertaining to health, safety, and sanitation requirements. It's been a long-held tenet of cosmetologists that individuals that cut or take care of individuals' hairs should at least know the basic hygiene requirements, such as cleaning your combs and different instruments between clients. And certainly another factor in rule is the fact that should any individual that's working on your hair come upon certain scalp diseases and things, they are forbidden from doing any further work on that individual. They must tell that individual to seek medical treatment before any further work is done. Additionally, the effective dates on this are out over a year to allow the curriculum to be put into place and to make it as easy as possible on the practitioners. And I would stand for questions.
Members have any questions? Is there anybody here in the audience to speak for or against the bill? Senator Higgins, do you have anybody who's from doing this as a profession, or can you tell me if you had contact with those people and what they may have said about your legislation?
Madam Chair, what I have had contact is with people who are clients of some of the braiders,
okay.
And they have mentioned to me that many of the salons are not very hygienic. What happens is that in an effort to not be considered a hair salon, where you would have to be licensed in cosmetology, and you don't have the sinks and the mirrors and all that kind of thing, often what the braiders will do will just be get kind of a storefront. In some cases, it doesn't even have running water in it. And their clients are supposed to come with clean hair and ready to go. Because they know that they're not supposed to have their hair washed there. It's only the braiding aspect. But I think some folks have gone overboard in trying to not be a salon and now aren't being as hygienic as they should be in an effort to, you know, push that piece off. And so I think we need to bring them back a little. And this is a very modest proposal. Have some classes in the hair braiding. The health and safety and sanitation aspects of it. We also say on page 2 that we encourage the coursework to be developed in other languages. In my neighborhoods, there are a lot of East African and West African women who are doing this to make a living, and so it would make sense to have that done in languages other than English. So.
Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, the language on line 6 about solely for compensation, I presume that's to address the kids who do each other's hair and they pay them a few bucks as part of it. In other words, it has to be a professional hair braider that you're going after.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, that's correct. It's for the people who are trying to make a living doing this, not the moms who are braiding their children's hair or, you know, sisters and neighbors and that kind of thing.
Any other questions by members? Anybody again in the audience that wishes to speak for or against the bill?
Might look good on me.
Yeah, it would help.
You need to let it grow a little longer. Senator. A little longer.
Or you want
to, Madam Chair, it needs to go to finance.
Okay. Senator Metzen then moves that Senate File 1677 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to finance. Any comments or conversation about that? Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails.
And thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Higgins. Mr. Hurst, thank you. And then Senator Higgins.
Chair, the next bill deals with coverage for interpreter services.
And we have that as a re-referral, am I correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay.
And I have a delete everything amendment.
Okay, it's the A4, I believe. So, Senator Higgins, that's being passed out. Actually, at this point, it wouldn't be an author's amendment, so we'll let you explain what it is we want to do.
Madam Chair, I have been trying to figure out a way for the last couple, we have a handout here too, the last couple of years, how to get appropriate interpreter services for people when they go off to get health care. And it is, in the last biennium, it got finally sent off to be a study, and then we've come back this year, put in another bill, and yet all the folks involved have continued to negotiate on this, and the A4 is the result of the negotiations. It would put into place that the health plans must cover the interpreter services provided to both deaf and hard of hearing clients, as well as those needing language interpreters. We pushed that that mandate out to be effective July 1st of 2008. And then we also put in an interpreter services work group to try to figure out whether there is whether they can identify any different funding mechanism rather than having the health plans pay for it. And is there anything that I missed in? Okay, I think that's the gist of it, Madam Chair.
I'm looking at.
Oh, that's right, and looking at the professional requirements needed for interpreting for medical situations. You know, you may be able to interpret, but if you have to do an otorhinolaryngology sort of thing, you might have to bone up on what some of those, you know, some of the language of the profession, the medical profession. And so that work group would also work on those issues to make sure that the interpreters are good interpreters and qualified.
Is that item parent 3 on page 3?
Section... The work group is on section 2.
Right, and on page 3 is...
And page 3 are at the bottom of page 2 and then the top of page 3 is the charge to the work group. assuring access to interpreter services, complying with federal laws, developing the quality assurance program to make sure that they're good interpreters in the medical business, and trying to figure out a different funding mechanism.
Well, Senator Higgins, it strikes me that it's a very important area when you have people who are not English speaking, and my concern would be for the quality of that interpretation, if you will. Pretty important stuff. So, do you have some people to testify?
We do.
Okay, and then I'm going to ask the health plans or whatever to speak as well. Senator Rivness, did you?
I was here basically to answer questions. Okay. I've been working, Madam Chair, on this issue, I think, for 5 years.
Okay.
And it's been quite a journey, but we really feel that we have a good compromise. The working group will come up with some very, very good standards for proficiency for the interpreter profession. So I think it'll be a good bill.
Senator Higgins, the delete everything amendment represents the work of the negotiations and the conversations you've had with health plans, with providers, I assume, and with...
Yeah, Madam Chair, maybe I can speak to that. Actually, this issue is a top priority not only for the Medical Group Management Association, which I belong to, but the MMA, the sort of Hospital Association, the Rural Health folks, and sort of Provider Coalition. But the agreement has been worked out with the Council of Health Plans and major health plans. As Senator Higgins pointed out, the effective date for the requirement to pay has been shifted to next year to give this work group a chance to come up with both a way to ensure good quality interpreters, but also presumably to look to see if there's any other funding source that would be appropriate. But if they don't come up with one, then the requirement goes into place in July 1st of 2008.
Mr. Senator Rivness, Do you know if anybody is paying for this now, or any?
Yes, indeed. Actually, this very committee, I think, quite a few years ago, required that auto insurers cover interpreter services, workers' comp covers interpreter services, and our public programs like medical assistance and prepaid medical assistance all cover interpreter services. So this would be adding a group. There's still another group out there that if anybody has any creative ideas, we'd love to hear them, but the self-insured still would not be required, although there's some indication that the business partnership, who represents a number of those large companies who hire recent immigrants, may sit down and visit with us about that issue as well. So there's a lot of payers already for interpreter services. We're adding health plans.
Okay. Senator Higgins, you have someone else to...
Madam Chair, to my left is Lawrence Massa. He is the CEO at Rice Memorial Hospital in Wilmer.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lawrence Massa, and I'm the Chief Executive Officer at Rice Memorial Hospital in Wilmer, Minnesota. Rice is a 100-bed hospital serving about 14 counties in west central and southwest Minnesota. On behalf of the Minnesota Hospital Association and our 135 members, I'm here today to express our strong support for this bill, Senate File 827. This bill would require private insurance, as you have heard, to reimburse hospitals and other providers for language interpretation services. This financial reimbursement is needed at Minnesota's hospitals across the state and in the clinics as well. From my work at the hospital and my involvement in the community, I can tell you that the demand for interpreter services is a statewide issue and is not exclusive to the Twin Cities, and it's a growing issue. Between 1990 and 2000, the state saw dramatic increases in diverse populations and accordingly diverse language needs. More than 80 communities throughout the state saw their minority populations at least double during that decade, fueled almost exclusively by non-English-speaking immigrants. Some cities like Long Prairie and Le Sueur saw their diverse populations increase 1,000%. In Wilmer, we experienced a 137% increase when many Spanish and Somali-speaking individuals and families moved to our community. In the Willmar Public Schools, school children today speak 22 different languages. And I would refer to the map on the handout that was distributed that's on the back that shows the number of non-English speaking students in the various areas throughout the state. So you can see it is a statewide issue. Before 1990, we had almost no need for language interpretation services. Today, however, Spanish and Somali are the two languages most frequently spoken by our patients other than English. We use a combination of contract interpreters and a national phone-based service called the Language Line. In 2006, our unreimbursed interpretation expenses at Rice Memorial exceeded $100,000. And that's up about $30,000 from the previous year, so it is a very rapidly growing expense. Hospitals are required by the federal government to provide language interpretation. We also know that quality of care can be greatly impacted by inadequate interpretation and understanding. As our staff and physicians have become more aware of the need for interpretation, so has our utilization. Hospitals want to deliver high quality care and good patient outcomes. Insurers want their enrollees to experience high-quality care and good outcomes as well. For individuals with language barriers, interpretation is an absolute essential to achieving these goals. Hospitals already incur these costs to provide these services. I strongly support this bill and ask that the health plans and insurers step up and share the cost of interpretation services on behalf of their subscribers and our patients. Thank you for your consideration, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions from members? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Mr. Masser, or Mr. Rivness, or Senator.
Senator Marty, we can't hear you.
The question is on page 1, line 21. You are requiring the health plan company to establish a network of interpreter service providers and require use of its own. What if they don't want to do it that way? Or is that an option and I'm reading it wrong?
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, we're actually giving as much flexibility as we can. Each of the plans currently that participates in PMAP already have a roster of interpreters, and that system works very well. So either those interpreters could be extended to the healthcare practitioner, or in some cases, some of the hospitals and some of the clinics actually have interpreters on staff. And so then they'd work out a way to reimburse for some of those fixed costs. So the interpreting could be over the telephone, under contract, or through an employee. And we wanted to give the health plans flexibility in making sure that they could work that out with each provider.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Rivness, I'm not sure if this is a problem or not, but I'm just wondering, because you are requiring the use of its own network of interpreter service providers. Presumably they want that, but so requiring them to do what they want to do is fine, but why are you requiring them to use their own?
Senator Rivness.
I think the require refers to shall pay, and then it says as required in paragraph A, either by establishing a network, or they can consider a little later here to use the interpreter that's already on the staff with the provider. So I think at least the way we tried to craft this is that would be an option. But I think each of the health plans currently has their own roster of interpreters that have been used for prepaid medical assistance.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, maybe Senate Counsel, I must be reading it wrong or something, because it sure sounds like they have to use their own network, and maybe you mean it as an option for either their own network or the provider's interpreter service. But the language on lines 22 and 23 seem to say you require the use of their own. It doesn't say or you can do this.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr. Stanton.
Am I reading it wrong?
I think Senator Marty may have a point there. If you look also on page 2, lines 6 and 7, it says nothing requires the health plan company to establish a network, but that's kind of inconsistent with the sentence that Senator Marty was reading. I don't know if may pay for interpreter services makes more sense there or not, but I think he may have a point.
Ms. Kmet, do you have a comment to make on, or some enlightenment for us?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Catherine Kmet from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. In response to Senator Marty's question, the language contained in Section 2, or I should say paragraph, Section 1, paragraph B, gives us the comfort we asked for in this language to allow us to be able to form networks of providers. It doesn't mean that we have to do it, but we do like to form networks. That's part of the health plan's managed care business model, and so that's language that we asked specifically to be in the bill so that we would be allowed to have networks.
Ms. Kmet, does it mean that if you're going to provide the service, that this is a way of doing it? Is that because it says you don't, you know, Mr. Stang points out in parent E on page 2, nothing requires the health plan company to establish a network, but this is if you do it. It doesn't really say that, but can you tell us, can you distinguish here for us?
Madam Chair and members, yes, under Section 1, paragraph A, the first sentence there says a health plan must cover sign language interpreter services provided and language interpreter services provided to enrollees with LEP. So there's the mandate language. Then it goes on to say that if in the process of carrying out that mandate, health plans are allowed to form networks, but they don't necessarily have to form networks, or if it's impossible to form a network in that area, they aren't going to be penalized for not having a network, but it is still their responsibility to pay for coverage of those services. And how they get those services may be by either forming a network or contracting directly with a provider, an interpreter provider who is employed by a clinic or a hospital, or by using a third party like a language line or some other type of facility that provides interpreter services.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Ms. Kmet, if you change the word shall to may on line 21, I think it would accomplish what you want, but I'm not trying to mess up somebody's agreement. I just don't think the language does what you say it does. This says they shall pay for what they have to do under paragraph A by doing this and requiring the use of its own people. And again, as Senate Counsel pointed out, that's contradicting by page 2, lines 6 and 7, but I think if you change it to may, it might work. It might not be contradictory.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Marty.
Yes, Ms. Kmet.
This language, let me just say that what you're looking at is the result of many, many hours of negotiations, and at this time, I would be reluctant to make that change because I think it's important that we have the word shall so that it it forces the health plans to, or it ensures that the health plans can have networks. That's what we're trying to get at here. It doesn't mean that we must have a network if we aren't able to have one or cannot have one there, but if we choose or want to have a network, that the health plan is not precluded from having that network. And so this, we feel that this language takes care of that issue for us. So at this time, we would prefer to leave the language the way it is.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Ms. Kmet, I don't think the language accomplishes what you want. I'm not trying to mess up your compromise. I'm trying to tell you that this doesn't say that you may create a network of services. This says you shall pay for them by establishing the network, and you shall require the use of your own network. I understand why you want to have that option, and I'm not arguing that point. I'm just saying that I think what you've got here is language that does not accomplish what you want. That's why I would suggest, and unless Senator Higgins has a big problem with this, I'd like to move that we replace the word shall with may on line 21 and ask...
Yeah, I was going to say, let's just get rid of this.
Ask you to take another look at that, because I... What you're saying you want it to accomplish, the language does not do.
To may establish a network.
Put a period after it.
Madam Chair and members, and Senator Marty, I guess that would be okay to change it to may if you like, and we can continue to look at this language going forward. We'd be happy to take it back and talk with our folks back at our plans, but we're fine to do that.
Although...
Senator Prentice Solon.
Madam Chair, although Senator Marty, in line one, okay, point 32, it says if a health plans company, health plan companies or providers, what does it say?
Madam Chair, once again, we can't hear you.
On lines 1.32 and 1.33, it says, if a health plan companies or providers employed or contracted interpreter service is unavailable to provide interpreter services, says that right. then shall reimburse. Right. So I'm wondering if the shall doesn't fit up above.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Prentice Solon, the way it is right now, line 32 and page 2, line 6, are contradicting line 21. If you put may in there, it works. Both of those things, the health plan has the choice. They may pay for it by establishing a network and requiring its own, or if it's unavailable or they choose not to, they don't have to. But the health plan does have the choice if you have the word may in there. If you have the word shall in there, it contradicts the later language. So I think it works, and they can take another look at it, but it's contradictory right now.
Senator Olson, can you help us?
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I just have to say, reading this, I would tend to agree with Senator Marty that I do think it still makes sense to say that they have the option. If it's not available, then they have the option to pay for separate interpreter services. But if you say they have to, if you say on line 0.21 that they are required to establish a network, then line 0.32 situation would never come up.
I guess I'm agreeing with Senator Marty as well. I mean, I think that's how I read it. Senator Higgins, are you?
Madam Chair, if you want to change shall to may on 1.21, go right ahead, and we'll get all the attorneys that have been talking among all of these groups back together and see if there's something else that they need to do somewhere. But go ahead and do that one at this point. And we have such a fragile agreement here that that's, I think, why we're hesitating. But
Ms. Kmit, I would ask, it sounds like plans are doing some reimbursement here already, some paying for some of these services. Is it? It's just in those limited situations that Senator Higgins or Senator Rivenis described.
Madam Chair and members, the health plans contract with DHS to provide services or provide coverage for persons covered under government programs, and as a result of those programs, they are required to provide or pay for interpreter services. And so health plans have, and they get that as part of their reimbursement from DHS to provide those services. So health plans have contracted with various provider organizations, have contracted with clinics and hospitals and such to form networks of providers where those populations are. So yes, health plans do have some experience in working with interpreter services providers for these types of populations.
Senator Prentice Solon.
Madam Chair, I do think there should be language in here, though, that says that there should be some outreach to the hospitals and providers, letting them know the services available, because I don't think that most places, or at least the ones I've been familiar with, maybe there are some that are quite familiar, I'm not sure that everybody is familiar with that, and they end up eating the cost of the interpreter also without it going through the health plan.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Prentice, so when that may be the case, I think they'll learn very quickly, though, because it is expensive.
And well, so it happens now.
Yeah. But right now they don't have the way to get reimbursed.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, I can address that question. In Willmar, we know that the health plans have contracts, but most of their contracts are with larger interpretation firms based in the Twin Cities or in the seven-county metro area. So the interpreters that we use in Willmar are not part of that of that network. They have not come out and contracted with those smaller players, and so we don't have that advantage. So we end up eating the cost of the interpreter service because they're not part of that network. Now, maybe that will happen someday, but that's not the case where we're at today.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Just to remind you of the work group that's on the back half of the bill, and I think Senator Solon's point is well taken, and that should be one of the things that the work group would have, you know, discussions about, is the outreach to let people know that this is now available. So, I think Ms. Kmit's written herself a mental note, and if this passes, I know she'll be part of that group.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, just going back to the, and maybe we don't need to belabor this point, but on line point 21, if we were to change the word shall to the word may, the way I'm reading this, that would give the health plan providers the latitude to decide if they want to form a network, and it would give the health care facilities the protection that there would be a reimbursement paid one way or the other. And so I guess in terms of your agreement and wanting to keep everyone on board with the language of this bill, maybe I'm missing something, but is there a specific concern that that language change would lead to some problem that we're not seeing here, or is it just a concern that any change, is it just a general concern?
Senator Higgins or Ms. Kmit?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, yeah, I think that we've gone over this language, and like I said before, we've spent numerous hours poring over the and parsing over these words. And so, you know, I think that this is fine to say may. I'm reluctant to make any changes because we've had other people come to us and say, oh, we'd like to do something to this language, and we've said no because we have this compromise. But I think this is probably an okay change to make, and so we're fine with that.
So Senator Marty moves an amendment to the delete all, delete everything amendment on line 1.21, change shall to may. Is that accurate? Any further discussion of that? Senator Higgins, it sounds. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. The motion prevails. So we've amended the delete everything amendment. It now says may there.
Have we moved to delete everything yet?
We haven't. So we'll. Senator Marty moves the A4 amendment as amended. Is there any further conversation? Is there anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify? Thank you, Ms. Kmit. Welcome, Ms. Sexton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Erin Sexton with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I hate to throw cold water on a compromise, but I do appreciate the work that's been done by both the plans and the providers, but I think it's unfortunate that employers, the ones who will be expected to pick up the tab for this mandate if it is imposed, had been left out of the discussion. We were not party to this compromise, and so I do feel the need to once again be a broken record here in front of you on these healthcare mandates and bring up our opposition to adding more health insurance mandates to Minnesota's insurance products. As you all know, these mandates only apply to 27% of the insurance market, and these mandates are not paid for by the insurance companies. They're paid by the 27% who are insured in the fully insured market, and many of those are my members. This is not a bill about ensuring that people have access to interpreter services. This is a bill about who pays for them. And the bottom line is, instead of the providers paying for them, it now will be the 27% of the fully insured market. And we would ask you to reconsider the mandate portion of this bill and not adopt that piece. I think the work group piece is fine, but I think there is also one other thing to bring to your attention. We do have a statute, 62J.26, which does do an evaluation of proposed health coverage mandates and looks at the costs and implications of these mandates. And I would encourage you to look at this statute in reviewing this mandate that's proposed in this bill. With that, there should be a letter in your packet also from us, and I would thank you for the committee's time.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Sexton, aren't the providers also part of your membership? And when they are the ones that absorb the cost, it's a significantly higher cost than when it would be spread among the 27% who are insured under the health plans. Would you not also represent the hospitals and the health care providers?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, we do have health care providers that are part of our membership, and I appreciate the hardship that this puts onto them. But I also understand that, you know, when they're negotiating contracts, that this is currently a cost of their doing business. Whether that's the right way to fund it, I think is your prerogative to decide, and something that the study group will look at. Do I think that right now that's spread across their entire populations that they serve and they negotiate their health plan contracts? I think just mandating it onto 27% of the market that's mainly made up of small and medium-sized businesses who are already struggling to offer health care benefits to their employees is not the right solution.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question is maybe one I should address to Senator Marty, Senator Prettner-Solon, or anyone who can help me out with this. But does this language limit itself only to those private pay health plans, or would it not also apply to health plans covering, you know, where we have a contract for payment? And if that's the case, then it isn't just limited to that 27%.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, I think that what Ms. Sexton is saying is that most of the plans are group self-insured plans that are covered by ERISA laws, and we can't mandate the same on them.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I understand that, but there's also, I think when you're talking about that 27%, you're talking only about the private pay non-ERISA, and there's also another large section, which is the government-paid medical assistance, Medicare, where we are contracting with health plans, and that would then increase the percentage to a much larger percentage in terms of who will be picking up the tab for this, if I'm correct.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I believe those are already covered. They already offer interpreter services.
Okay.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Higgins.
There is nothing more fundamental to good health care than being able to talk to your physician, your nurse, your whoever's providing that health care, your dentist, whatever. This is such a fundamental, important item to be done. I'm always frustrated when it seems like the chamber comes and opposes all of my bills. So I guess I should get used to it. But.
Madam Chair, and I understand this is fundamental to people's health care, but I don't think this is about ensuring that people have access to interpreter services.
Yeah,
they
is.
Do right now. Their providers pay for it and are charged with ensuring they have they are able to speak with their patients and make sure they get good health care. This is shifting the cost to another sector of our population. This is about who pays for the services, not ensuring that patients get these services.
You know, my first inclination was, and I think I discussed this with Senator Higgins, was to send this for a mandate review because we are concerned about mandates, and we have piled on mandates in Minnesota. I think we're over 60, and I don't know if that's more than any other state, but it's certainly one of the highest, if not the highest, in the country. I understand the importance of this. The fact, Ms. Sexton, that Senator Higgins, as part of the work of the negotiating, has come up with the work group to look at these issues, I think, is important to me to maybe not have to do that. Not to ask the Department of Commerce to do a mandate review. It almost seems as if that work group is going to be doing its own review of this mandate. Is it, Senator Higgins, is that how you see this? I mean, they'll be looking at these very issues.
Madam Chair, I think that that should be something that they look at for sure. It looks to me in the charge to the work group that fits in there fairly nicely. And, Madam Chair, I have a note here from Ms. Smith at Dewar who says she's got a fiscal note on this bill, and I don't know quite why.
Yes, there's someone. Good afternoon.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Nathan Morocco, and I'm the manager for the State Employee Group Insurance Program. The reason there's a fiscal note is that even though the state group program, which you are also a part of, even though we are self-insured, in statute we are required to follow state mandates, so that's why there's a fiscal note, where currently these services are not directly part of our program. The fiscal note just represents what the cost would be to this mandate.
See it?
Do you have a fiscal note already?
Yes, there has been a fiscal note logged. It is out there. I'll spare the details. It's sort of lengthy in terms of how we came up with our approximations, but it roughly represents about $3.6 million. Once you get, you know, beyond the phase-in period, so about 3 years out, it's about $600,000 for the first fiscal period, and then it gets to about $1.8 million. And then eventually gets out to about $3.6 million once you get 3 or 4 years out.
Senator Higgins.
It's so nice to know these things when you're sitting in the middle of a hearing. Madam Chair, so it's got to go to finance. So I think
state
point,
and
if you
local
would,
has asked for it.
As well. I don't know.
Yes, they asked for it.
Well, then if we could go to state and local first, please, then.
Yeah, that's where it would have to go. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Higgins. You know, as I look at this map that you passed out and drew a circle around my district, if I were to be just parochial about things, I would say, well, why should anyone in my district? It doesn't look like there's hardly anyone, you know, that would even be in need of these services, or very few people. But I would think, just from the time that I've spent on the Health and Human Services Committee since I've been here, we've had a lot of discussion about why preventative care is a lot more effective than dealing with things in the emergency room, and how expensive it is to provide services to people who can't afford health care. I would think that if people can't understand health care instructions that are given to them, it would also be in the long run more expensive to treat them, because if they're sent home with medications or with instructions they don't understand, it's much more likely they'll end up back in the emergency room again. And so when they're looking at this fiscal note, I would hope that they're taking into consideration not just the cost of the interpreter, but the cost of healthcare savings that we might see by not having to provide those more expensive services at a later date.
Thank you.
I think that's an excellent point, Senator Olson. Although I think it would have to go there. And state and local has asked. So that's where our motion is going to include sending it there. Senator Van de Veer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At $3.6 million just for the state employees is, I think that's a signal that this is probably a very, very large mandate that is going to have a pretty big impact on, could have a big impact on insurance premiums. What is the reason, Madam Chair, for not sending this through the review process?
Well, we could ask for that. That's what I had been inclined to do before Senator Higgins worked so hard on it, and the various interested parties did negotiate what we have in front of us. That was my inclination to ask for that.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Metzen.
You know, it is and it isn't a mandate. This is a communications issue. It's a fundamental right of a person or people to understand what's covered. And we keep talking about mandates. Yes, it kind of it is, but at the same mandate is a procedure we talk about here that it's an add-on, and we all know what I'm saying. But this is just a fundamental right, like Senator Higgins said, for somebody to understand. They want to know. Tell me. And that might save a problem, Senator Olson, down the road a little bit if you know up front. So it might not only be a cost now, but it could be a savings over the years. If I go in and I understand what's going on, and I take the instructions, and I learn by them. So I think it's, again, it's more of a communications issue, per se, than it in my judgment, as a mandate. People have the right to know. You're hard of hearing, you're deaf, and you're not proficient in English, you ought to be told what's going on.
Senator Vandeveer?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure that, I mean, a right is a pretty strong statement. And maybe it is, but it just concerns me that this will have obviously is going to have a large or a certain impact. Maybe it's not as large as we think, and maybe there might be savings that Doerr's not recognizing, but it looks to me, when you read the bill, that it's requiring a lot of investment, and I think we should have some idea what that impact is going to be statewide, because remember, every time we raise insurance premiums, we take people off the insured rolls. So, you know, there's needs to be balance, and I think it's kinder to have people able to afford insurance than make it so that they can't even buy it. So that's my concern. I think we should maybe study it, Madam Chair, and send it through the process and get an idea of what we're looking at. That's all I'm saying.
Madam Chair, Senator Vandeveer, this has an effective date of July 1st of 2008, and so the study will be done before it actually goes into effect. And if there, you know, one of the things that they are going to study is maybe there is another way to pay for this. But the costs are already in the system. And your public hospitals, you know, HCMC, I think, has an interpreter bill of $5 million or something. It is a cost that's already there. And we have... As Ms. Kmit and Senator Rivness said, you just kind of can't believe the number of hours that people have put into this trying to come in to an agreement on this is not my first go-round on this bill. You know, I seem to have history with this bill these days. So it's not something we just kind of dreamed up and, you know, we want to dump on people. There have been lots of people talking about it, lots of people studying it. And I think, you know, the work group can look at the issue of the mandate, and I would like to think that the work group will also have somebody from Doerr into it, and you know, be part of it, and see whether those costs are actually accurate or whether they were pulled out of thin air, and if they can be adjusted in some way. So, you know, I got a couple more stops to go before we're done. But
one final
I'd
point, Madam
it
Chair.
Senator Vandeveer.
And I think that's worth noting what you said. And my only thought is if this doesn't go through the working group, study group, I can't imagine what would. We've skipped it a few times this year. But this one does seem like if we're not going to send one like this there, then... when would we?
Well, Senator Vandeveer, I think that the fiscal note was late in coming. If you look at page 2, section 2, the work group, the Commissioner of Health, in consultation with Commissioner of Commerce, which, as well as Human Services and Employee Relations, they're going to be part of that work group to look at these questions and these issues. I share your concern. I think it is an expense. I think we're paying for it, however, in a different, perhaps more expensive way today. In Hennepin County, that would be our property tax. And just about every place else, you know, when there's uncompensated services provided. So, and I think what Senator Olson said about, and Senator Prettner-Solon are saying, and Senator Metzen, that their savings, I don't think, are figured into that fiscal note, but that's something that at some point, I don't know if the Finance Committee will look at it that way, but I think we can. And if we believe that there's ultimately a savings to people understanding what their health care situation, what their health situation is, and what they ought to do about it, that there's got to be a cost savings there. I mean, we know there is. So I understand your concern, but I think that the fact that this doesn't have an effective date, well, you know, the commissioner will make those recommendations. Talk to me. Okay, it's July 1st of next year when the reimbursement would take place. That's on page 2. I'm sorry. So that is time for the legislature to look at this again and to consider it. It's a little different than most of the mandates that come through here. I mean, I think that an awful lot of work by a lot of parties have gone into this. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I just want to add one more thing to what you were just saying about the savings. It's not only the savings that Senator Olson was pointing out of people getting the right care and knowing what to do, but also when you have a small provider who is trying to quickly call up somebody and get an interpreter in to deal with a patient, it's a lot more expensive than if, frankly, if the health plans set up their own networks and they can provide them by, it says, telephone, by fax, by a whole range of things, can do it a lot more. I have a feeling you could significantly save money in the interpreters that are provided under this. But I'll move if we have adopted the A4 amendment.
No, we have not. Senator Marty, so you're going to move the A4 amendment. Senator Marty moves the A4 amendment as amended. You recommended to pass. It would become then Senate file, and we'll vote on that next. Is there any discussion on that? Senator Prentner-Solon.
Madam Chair, I think that it's accurate to say that we are really dealing with the policy of this, right? And it makes good policy to allow patients to have interpreters so that they can communicate with their health care providers. I think that it's up to the finance division to decide whether or not the state can afford it.
Senator Prentner-Solon, I think that's true. I know there's always a concern in this committee, though, about what we are doing to impact the cost of premiums for people who are paying for health insurance and to employers. As Ms. Sexton pointed out, obviously they have a concern. But essentially, you're right. We're talking about the policy here. So all those in favor of the Marty amendment, Marty motion, excuse me, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails, and we have then Senate file 827 as amended. Senator Metzen and Marty are going to fight over this. I'm going to mediate it and call on Senator Marty. is going to move then. Senator Marty will move that Senate file 827 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the state and local government operations committee. Is there any further discussion? Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak to this further? Seeing no one, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Senator
Higgins,
thank you.
Thank you all very
thank
much.
You.
Thank you.
And thank you to those who spoke. Senator Tomasoni, and then Senator Olson will do yours. Okay, and then we'll do mine. I don't know. Does yours have to go someplace else? Oh, yeah, one. Okay. Okay. Thank you. Senator Tomasoni, you've waited so patiently.
I've been very patient, Madam Chair. Thank you for hearing my bill also. Madam Chair, there's an amendment. I don't know if you want to put
Is that the A1 amendment
yes.
to put this bill? Let's see. We have. Okay, is this just an office amendment at this point?
So. It's a good question.
We have the
file.
We have the House file.
It's
the first time it's being heard in the Senate, so I think we'll take it yep. as an author's amendment. Is this?
Madam Chair, what the amendment does is it just makes it clear that flags for that this bill would pertain only to flags for sale at the retail level, and it also. Says that the effective date would be January 1st of 2008 instead of after final enactment.
So,
the reason for that is because many of the retailers have already purchased or ordered their stock for this summer. And so in order to make sure that that doesn't affect what's already happened, we want it to go into effect next year.
So Senator Sparks would move the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape Senator Tomassoni would like, an author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, Senator Tomassoni.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Sparks. House File 122, Madam Chair, is the language that passed off the House floor, and it's been amended with the A1 amendment. Madam Chair, since the advent of 9/11 and the ensuing wars that the United States has been fighting, people in the United States have been asked to show their patriotism by displaying the American flag. And as we go around the state and around the country, even around the world, we see Americans everywhere flying flags, putting flags as stickers on their cars, showing their patriotism by displaying the American flag. And although, Madam Chair, the American flag is being displayed all over the place, Still, jobs are being outsourced and products are being imported from other countries as a result of these jobs that have been outsourced, and Americans are basically buying a real lot of products from other countries that have previously been manufactured in the United States. This is all about business, and this is all about cost, but it seems to me that if we're going to tout our patriotism by showing the American flag, the least we can do is require that the American flag be manufactured in the United States. And so what this bill does, Madam Chair, is just require that any flags that are sold at retail be manufactured in the United States.
The bill's changed a bit since when it was introduced.
Yes, it has, yes.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Tomassoni, are you sure that your bill will be able to meet the demand of the consumers?
Oh, I'm
Senator Tomassoni.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure, but I would think it would be easily done.
Madam Chair and Senator
if
Johnson.
If nothing else, Senator Johnson, we'll make them on the iron range.
Senator Tomassoni, after 9/11, you could not keep enough flags in the retail outlets.
It was impossible. I'm aware of that.
Senator
and they were coming from all over the world, but at this point in time I can't see any reason why we can't manufacture flags in the United States for Americans to buy.
Senator
Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Tomassoni, I support your bill.
Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Tomassoni, I certainly support the sentiment of your bill. But now the lawyer in me has to ask, is there anything else like this that we regulate this way, so that we don't run afoul of any federal or even state, you know, laws that say we have trade agreements and we have all kinds of things that can we do this legally? I mean, is that something that has been
what we do here?
Senator Tomassoni.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, what we do here is pass laws, and then they become legal. Well, and then somebody.
Well, now there's an somebody, analysis.
Well, somebody. So then we have a check and balance system that decides whether or not you can do it. So,
Senator Prentner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Olson, you should ask Senator Tomassoni how many times he's passed legislation that projects in Minnesota have to be built with iron range steel.
Senator Johnson.
And Mr. Senator Tomassoni, that having been said and that being true, we should put an amendment on here that you can't offer an amendment for the taconite industry.
Well, actually, it was suggested to me that
Senator
Johnson, Madam Chair, instead of putting manufactured in the United States, it should be said manufactured on the Iron Range, but I declined to accept that.
So I think Senator Metzen went to get us something to show us, but we may deal with your bill before he gets back.
Okay.
I assume it's a flag made someplace else or
I hope
probably
not.
A pin. But this does not have to do with things like lapel pins or
Madam Chair, we took
scarves
all that, yeah, we took
or,
all
know,
that
other
stuff
items.
Off. This applies to flags only. So,
the flag, does it apply to those small flags?
Well, I knew you were going to ask me that, and I'm not sure. I don't know if those would be considered trinkets or oh yeah, there, here it's an American flag. I don't know.
Exhibit A.
This is made in China. So that's what he which is why I don't have one on my lapel.
Senator Metzen apparently has a few of them.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Metzen.
And I don't think
Senator Metzen.
I always cut off the wrappers though first, but today. I had a very little. American flags.
Made in China.
Exhibit A. Mm-hmm. Do we count, Madam Chair, the little guys like this?
No, well, Senator Metzen, I think not. I think we were just saying that.
But we amend
Well, actually, Madam Chair, Senator
Tomasoni.
Senator Metzen, they were included in the original language of the bill, but they were removed on the House floor, so we're using the same language that they have in the House.
Well, we've amended it, though, even further. Am I correct?
Yes, and we've amended it even further. So, in fact, Madam Chair, one of the concerns, the reason for making it goods offered at retail only is because we don't want somebody who's selling something at a garage sale to get fined for selling something that they maybe had in their basement for a while or something to that effect. So it's intended to be retail products.
And with that, I'd like to ask if a representative from the retailers would speak to us about this. I assume that you've been working with these people. Mr. Anderson, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Buzz Anderson, President of the Minnesota Retailers Association. And, in fact, I have not talked to Senator Tomasoni about this.
Okay.
I have actually worked on so many bills this year, I haven't even gotten to this one. I would just say, since you asked the question, Madam Chair, and my apologies to Senator Tomasoni for not talking to him, we would, of course, oppose this as we have in the past. I think one of the reasons is going to be for the very reason that Senator Olson raised, is that you probably can't do this legally based on trade agreements that the United States has passed. It might actually violate, I'm trying to think of not due process, but rather the provision in law that allows that disallows states from regulating interstate commerce. So, I mean, I think it's probably going to be in violation of that. And furthermore, you're not going to have any impact on anybody that buys things on the Internet. I mean, and if flags get too expensive here, for whatever reason, people will go buy them on the Internet. And the Minnesota retailer is the one that loses out. So you may, in fact, the unintended consequence, you may see less flags being flown, too. I actually don't know what the price difference is going to be. I suspect it will be more, but we have always opposed this in the past, and we would continue to oppose it now.
Senator Tomasoni, do you know if any other state has done this?
No, but, Madam Chair, I would hope that this passage of this bill creates a landslide of legislation across the United States and possibly even at the federal level.
Okay, Mr. Anderson, thank you. I didn't know. I thought you'd been working with it.
Madam Chair, thanks for asking.
Yes, Senator Vandiver.
Maybe Senator Metzen or Senator Marty, would it be legal to wear this in now?
I don't think you should, no.
Well, I think it would continue to be legal if Senator Tomasoni's bill were to pass and become law.
The pin isn't included in the bill.
The pin is not included, right. So people can still, forgive me, buy underwear. Yeah. That's got the flag motif. I mean, seriously, it offends me when I see people wearing, well, not necessarily the underwear. But
I'm not
I've seen it in catalogs.
And in catalogs. Stick to that. Yeah.
And I've seen, and I've seen flags on all kinds of things. I mean, scarves, neckties, you name it. And some of the apparel or items are less dignified than others, and some are offensive. And this is, but this is strictly about the flag that we fly.
Absolutely.
And it's we aren't sure if it covers the little ones. I have a feeling it does.
Oh, man.
But probably not the bunting that you see at political conventions or the little plastic flags that decorate. Probably doesn't include those because they're not actually flags.
I would say that's accurate. And, Madam Chair, I thought about this earlier, and I I would be willing to have a discussion. I don't know what to say right now, but I would be willing to have a discussion with somebody as to whether or not there would be a maximum or minimum size that it covers, because I know some of the little paper flags that they put in the... Okay. I mean, I saw some this morning in the rural caucus that were, there were toothpicks with little flags on them in the fruit. And so, you know, I don't know if those little flags should be covered or not, but I mean, the intent is to cover flags. So we'll see what if there's a appropriate size that might be make this a little bit...
Senator Tomasoni, that might be a good idea if this bill goes forward.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, that's what I...
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, I'm curious by what you mean by United States of America, because a lot of made in USA products are sewn, usually fabric sewn on certain American protectorates and so on, where they don't even pay minimum wage and so on. I was curious if this is intended to be include those products, because I think this would probably encourage people to move them from, I would rather they pay them a decent wage in some country rather than in an American protectorate where they don't even pay a minimum wage. Just curious about what the intent is there.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I have, there's no intent in the bill to determine how much people are getting paid to make the flags as long as they're manufactured in the United States. And I actually have a resolution of support from the AFL-CIO on this bill. So.
Senator Marty. Chamber of Commerce. Yeah, Madam Chair, I think there should be a prevailing wage thing in that case, because
we can do that on the floor.
Yeah, we
can.
But Madam Chair, I think that the Made in USA label has been used in a way that has been very unfortunate in terms of where people are producing things, and in a very harmful way to the employees. And it's technically under the flag of the U.S. It's under our country's label. But I don't think that's an acceptable situation. Just to comment on that.
Okay. Is there any further discussion? Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had to go talk to a group of students, and I told them actually what the agenda was today in here, and I asked for a show of hands of about 30 students, and they all told me to vote no on this bill, so unanimously. And I didn't influence it either way, but I understand the gist and the intent and the spirit of this bill, but I have a question, Senator Tomasoni. There's no penalty specified, and I apologize if this question was asked, but if penalties are not specified, it defaults to the standard misdemeanor in state law. Is that your intention then?
Senator Tomasoni.
Yeah, Madam Chair, yes.
Okay, well, Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni,
Gerlach.
The penalty for a misdemeanor in state law is not more than 90 days in jail or no more than $1,000 fine. So in theory here then, and potentially in practice, if you sold a flag that wasn't made in America, you could be put in jail for 90 days. Is it your intent to put people in jail who do this?
Yes, of course.
Senator Tomasoni.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, they probably should be put in jail, but that's not my intent. But here's the deal. You missed the amendment. So it's only at the retail level. So in other words, if the flags have to be sold at the retail level, no, it's not my intent to put anybody in jail. And in fact, it's not even my intent to fine anybody. But considering the fact that if you don't have some teeth in the law, people won't do it, I think it's appropriate that a misdemeanor is associated with this bill. I would hope that if this bill does go into law, that retailers all across Minnesota would be purchasing flags that are made in the USA, and that people will be buying the flags made in the USA. And that's my intent. There's no intent whatsoever for people to be thrown in jail here.
Senator Tomasoni, have you investigated at all if the flag flying above the Capitol here, or the ones that they fly in Washington and Congress people send out to?
I'm afraid to look, Madam Chair. I'm afraid to look, actually, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
I would hope that those are the kind of things that we make sure are actually made in America.
Is there any further discussion? Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to speak to this bill?
Need a motion.
Senator Prentice-Olins.
Madam Chair, I'd move that Senate File 122 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the floor.
Senator Pretner Solon moves it.
Madam Chair, is it House File?
Yeah. House File 122. Oh, that's fine. House File 122, as amended, be recommended to pass and go to the floor. Any further discussion of that motion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? No. The motion does not prevail.
May I ask for a division?
You can't, but I can.
Okay.
I'll ask for a division.
All those in favor, raise your hand. Those opposed. I still don't think it prevailed, but I have to say the motion did prevail.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. Members.
Thank you, Senator Tomasoni.
Senator Shine.
Yes, Senator Olson.
You probably just didn't hear my vote because I said it real quietly since I'm real concerned about the legality of this bill, but I support its theory.
Senator Olson, I appreciate that. Thank you. So, Senator Olson, let's do your bill, and then we'll do my... Senator Scogin has a bill. He has three bills across the hall in this one. And I think, I don't know if all the members were here, but we're not going to meet this evening. We will, anything we don't finish.
Come on, we want to. Please.
Because I believe that it's really going to snow, even though I don't know if it's really going to do that or not, but I didn't want to put members to that. But we might have to on Thursday evening, but we'll probably have time on Thursday to do a couple of others of these bills if we don't. But Senator Olson. Has Senate File 1574. Senator Olson, have you had a bill before us yet?
Oh. Madam Chair, I'm not sure, but I may not have.
Oh. Okay.
For a while, things were happening so quickly, they're still kind of a whirlwind in my mind. But I'm here today to present Senate File 1574. And before I get started, so I don't forget, there is an A1 amendment, delete all amendment, to put the bill in the form that I'd like to have it presented, and this is its first stop.
Yes. And Senator Olson moves the A1 amendment to put this bill in the discussion, in the order which you wish to have it discussed. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Okay, Senator Olson. On Senate File 1574.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I think last week we were all hearing in the news and on television about a recent incident that happened at the TJ Maxx store where there was an unfortunate break into the security and a lot of personal identification numbers and credit card information was stolen. And basically what this bill is intended to address is to shift the responsibility from the credit card, the banks, the credit unions, whomever it may be who's issuing a credit card, to the retailer to perform certain things, but only in situations where the retailer has not complied with the provisions in the statute or in the proposed legislation that would require them to not hold PIN numbers, those numbers that are on the back of the card, and all of the data that's stored on a magnetic stripe. And basically, this is a consumer protection bill. This is a bill that, in fairness, allows... or puts the responsibility on the retailer in those situations when the retailer would be violating contract provisions that they typically have now with the card, with the credit card companies and the banks and credit card, the industries that provide the credit cards. So, with that, I have with me today to testify Bill Raker, who's the president of U.S. Federal Credit Union, and he will walk you through the bill and explain the reason, the problems that are are existing presently and why there's a need for this legislation. And then if there are other more technical questions, also with me today is Dana Hoffman Guy, who's general counsel for the Credit Union Network.
And welcome to our committees, Mr. Riker, is it?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Senator Olson. For the record, my name is Bill Raker. I'm a resident of Eagan, and I'm the president of U.S. Federal Credit Union in Burnsville. I'm here testifying today in support of Senate File 1574. Card fraud and mounting plastic card losses have become an increasingly large problem for the members of my credit union and for all consumers in Minnesota and consumers all across the country who carry credit and debit cards. One of the more recent extensive breaches, as Senator Olson referred to, was announced in late January, which involved the parent company of TJ Maxx, where over 40 million records were compromised. Many financial institutions in Minnesota were victims of the compromised data card base, and many Minnesotans personally experienced some of the consequences of that security breach. This impacted my credit union by our having to replace over 4,500 cards for our members. The cost to the credit union for just this data security breach alone was over $22,500. For my credit union, card security breaches have resulted in more than an additional $47,000 in losses beyond the cost of replacing the compromised cards. Currently, the cost of reissuing cards and expenses and losses related to actual and potential fraud normally all fall onto the card-issuing financial institution, regardless of where or how the security breach occurred. In addition to the time, the effort, and expense expended by the credit union to deal with the security breach, there was the limbo state, the confusion, the inconvenience, the anxiousness, and yes, even the fear each of those 4,500 cardholders experienced through the process of being informed that their card data had been compromised, that their old card was being canceled and a new one issued, and that they should monitor their accounts regularly and rigorously to determine if any fraud had been committed. The card replacement period often takes 10 to 14 days, during which time the individual may be without the use of their credit or debit card. To illustrate how people's lives can be seriously impacted because of a breach, I would like to share with you just a couple of examples. These are real stories that we've heard from our inconvenienced members. A family was on vacation when we had to close their cards because of security breaches and fraud activity. We had a member who wanted to purchase airline tickets online. We had blocked her card for fraud activity on the account, so she was not able to proceed with the transaction. When she went back later to purchase the tickets, they cost her several hundred dollars more. And we have also had senior citizens who have had medication regularly billed to their credit cards, and when the cards were blocked, it interfered with their ability to get access to their medication. One more thing to take note of is that the card-issuing institution suffers the loss of the member's trust in the institution and in the security of this delivery channel. Almost always, the cardholder incorrectly blames the issuing institution for the security breach and the resulting inconvenience. And we are indeed hearing from our members that they are losing trust in the credit union over these breaches. All of this, not because of something that the cardholder did or did not do, and not because of something the card-issuing financial institution did or did not do, but simply because the merchant and its processor illegally retained data they should not have and because they did not properly secure it once they had it. I think that this legislation is an important and very necessary first step toward protecting not just my members' information, but that of all of the millions of credit and debit card users in Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Riker. And is it Ms. Hoffman-Guy?
Hello, my name is Dana Hoffman-Guy. I'm the Executive Vice President and General Counsel for the Minnesota Credit Union Network. And thank you very much for listening to this bill. We, at the Credit Union Network, we represent 156 state chartered and federally chartered credit unions who have been very hard hit by these recent credit card breaches. We're mainly concerned, though, in addition to the financial institutions that are affected, but with what's happening with the consumer's information in these breaches. This legislation really is intended to mirror current standards that have already been adopted by the major credit card companies back in 2004. And all of the merchants have supposed to have been complying with these standards since 2005. And what we're finding is it's just in these breach situations, we're finding that many merchants do comply with it, but there obviously are several that are not. There are some current enforcement provisions in Visa rules, but we find that the enforcement is spotty at best. It's up to Visa to determine whether or not they want to impose, you know, penalties in conjunction with violations of these standards. And even when penalties are imposed, the penalties are just cover a fraction of the costs that are actually incurred by the financial institutions. It is our hope that we never even get to the remedies portion of this bill, that basically what happens is the merchants will stop, will comply with what they currently are required to comply with in their existing contracts, and that none of these security breaches will occur. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Are there any questions from members? Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, do you have any idea how many businesses do keep this data?
Ms. Hoffman-Guy?
Well, we don't have any firm numbers. We do know that in the TGX breach, I think there were 45.7 million cards compromised, debit card and credit cards compromised. So it can be quite widespread. We have been told, though, that many, many merchants already comply with these standards. So we believe it's possible. It's just when it doesn't happen, the damage that is done can be quite harsh.
Ms. Hoffman-Guy or Mr. Riker, what actually happened there? What did they keep, or what form was it in?
What we believe they kept is when you bring a card in, a credit card or debit card, when a consumer brings it into a merchant, they swipe the card. And on the back of that card, the magnetic stripe data contains very sensitive personal information about each card holder, including the name, the account number, the expiration date, and this very important security code known as the CVV or the CVV2. And what that is really the key, the special security code that enables a hacker to really create a card and start using it as their own. And those are the crucial security pieces that we're trying to keep the merchants from retaining. Also, if there are card-not-present transactions over the phone, there's something known as CVV2, which is that special number that people will ask you over the phone to provide. If they retain that, once again, if a hacker gets a hold of that, they can create a card and basically transact business with it as if it were their own.
So, Ms. Hoffman-Guy, are they retaining it in their computer system? That's where it is.
That's what we believe is happening, yes. That's how the hackers are getting then into their computer systems.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Olson, this is going to have a really adverse effect on small retailers. And I was wondering if there is an insurance clause in their policy, their business policies, that if something like this happens, if your law goes into effect, they're going to have some really huge damages. And I don't know that a lot of small businesses could weather that kind of a problem, because sometimes this information will go back 7-10 years in their computer systems.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, when I looked at carrying this bill, I guess my primary reason for wanting to become involved with it is because I want to be involved in helping to protect consumers, number one. And I think that even though consumers aren't directly named as a party to this, it's really a shifting of the responsibility between the banks and credit unions and those issuing credit cards to the retailers, it's only shifting that responsibility in situations where the retailer is not complying with agreements that are already being made and is using this information in a way that really is potentially very violative of the consumer's privacy. And the potential for damage to consumers, not just in terms of, because they don't have to be responsible for the actual loss, but it really does affect their credit. It affects I actually had this happen to one of my parents, where their identity was stolen because they were able to get enough personal information, not in this particular way, but in a different way. And by the time they were notified, within a couple of days, there already had been $30,000 worth of false charges that were run up on cards that were created under, because they had access to this type of information. And the amount of damage done to a consumer in that situation is really very severe. I did talk to, right before this hearing started, I talked to someone representing the retailers, because I do think that it's important not just to look at consumer advocacy, but to balance and to be fair between the banks and the credit unions and the retailers. And they mentioned that there was a concern that processing these charges sometimes takes about 48 hours, and that if they had to immediately release this information, it might be possible that they'd put a charge through and then maybe the credit card had been canceled or something and they wouldn't be paid. So there is a possibility that we might be looking, this is going to have at least one or perhaps two other stops, that we might be looking at some language, because we don't want to enact something that really practically is going to hurt someone who's following the law and following contractual responsibilities and doing things correctly. But it does seem fair to put some teeth into the requirements if this information is being misused or is being maintained in a way that it shouldn't be.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Senator Olson, that didn't answer my question. My question is, and maybe Mr. Anderson from the retailers could address this, is there in retailers' policies, insurance policies, coverages for this? Because I will tell you, probably 9 times out of 10, their controllers or their bookkeepers or whoever they have don't even understand what's on the computer, what they're supposed to be protecting the consumer from. And if we get this in law, we're going to have a lot of legal action on this.
Did you want,
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson? It's our understanding that when a merchant enters into the agreement with Visa or MasterCard, in that agreement there are certain standards and expectations that merchant is agreeing to abide by, and we're asking in this bill that those things be enforced. We understand that in almost every case, the reason for wanting to retain this data in the first place is as a convenience to the merchant or the processor. If there is a period of time, a short period of time, 24 hours, 48 hours, that needs to lapse for the transaction to be completed, we understand that. But what makes this so onerous to the card issuers is that these merchants and processors have been keeping this data for years and years and years for no legitimate reason, as we can tell from our point of view. If they insist on keeping the data, then they should be responsible for the security of that data. And if that security is breached, then they should have the responsibility of the consequences of that, not the card-carrying individual and not the financial institution.
Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I don't think that the retailer knows how to take that out of their computer systems.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, I would suggest to you that anyone that takes the responsibility of accepting this kind of very significant private data shouldn't be engaged in that practice unless they understand how to protect it correctly. And this can be a very significant and very very costly lesson to learn when something like this happens. And this is something in other committees as well we've talked a lot about, because with the advent of the internet and as easy as it is to store and this kind of very sensitive data, we need to be looking at consumer protection in this area and privacy protection in this area. And I think that this is reasonable to just say to say that you are not, first of all, it's already a requirement that they're supposed to follow. Secondly, in terms of eliminating the information, I can't believe that there isn't software that could be sold. I mean, we have software for just about everything that we can't, that it has to be such an onerous, difficult thing to get rid of the stored data.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Olson, the reason I'm belaboring this is because I know firsthand when I closed up my Blaine Hardware this summer, we were not able to sell any of our computers because even if we had removed the information, it's stored internally in the computer. So to protect that information, we could not sell those computers. So I'm saying that the retailer, even in efforts to try and secure that, still has that in their store in those internal memory computers.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, you know, I really wish I were a computer technology expert, and I'm certainly not. And I do understand the point that Senator Johnson's made, and I think that when we use computers as business people, and I've owned a small business as well, that we take that responsibility, and we should take that responsibility very seriously, not to do things like selling computers that could possibly expose people's confidential information. However, and I guess because I'm not an expert, I guess maybe I'll turn this over to counsel to see if she can address your concern.
I can tell you that the major credit card companies provide a lot of guidance to small and large retailers on how they can comply with this, and they've obviously come together as an industry to decide what they think is actually workable for merchants, and have come together in the major credit card companies and determined that this is possible. They provide a list. A lot of small retailers, I would presume, would use outside processors. Visa, MasterCard, and the other major credit card companies provide a list to retailers of compliant processors who can make sure that this information is handled in compliance with these PCI data security standards. So they do a lot for the small retailers and the large retailers to let them know how they can get this done. And there are processors out there who are doing it already. They've got lists of them available for all the merchants.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is just a personal opinion, but since I know that the credit cards are already charging between 1.5% to 3.5% on those transactions, I would oppose this bill because I think that they can provide this service much easier than the retailers.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Senator Johnson. The problem is they can't provide this service because this isn't happening while the data is within their control.
Oh, it is. It goes straight to the
This bill is only addressing the data while it's in the control of the retailer or those persons that they've hired to process it. That's the whole problem. Because if it's something that's happening when it's within the control of the credit card companies, my understanding is this bill doesn't have any impact on that. It's only while the data, how it's handled by the retailer is what this bill is attempting to target.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, if I may contribute as well. The fee structure that the credit card companies operate under were designed many years ago, several years ago, at a time when security breaches was not even a thought in anyone's mind. This is a recent development that was not taken into consideration when the fee structures were determined several years ago. So I believe that there is no provision included in the fee structure today for the kinds of expenses and losses that can be associated with these significant breaches.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Olson.
I think another point to be made is that really we don't want to just accept these losses as a given and say, well, we're going to build it into a cost for someone here or a cost for someone there, because ultimately it's a cost that ends up being borne by consumers, whether it's passed on by retailers or financial institutions. If we can do something to prevent these kinds of losses from occurring and to protect this private data from the people who are out on the Internet trying to misuse the data, That's the point of this bill. By putting the financial responsibility on the institution that has the ability to do something about it while it's within their control and making making it their responsibility, we're hoping to prevent these kinds of things from occurring in the future.
Senator Johnson, and then we're going to keep moving here.
Yeah,
so
one last one.
I'm going to ask if there's anybody else to testify on this as well. So, Senator Johnson.
And thank you, Madam Chair. My question or comment was going to be that then when the breach is at the cardholder level, there has to be some of the same type. But I know there already is, so I guess that comment doesn't hold any water. But I just think that as you move forward with this, you have to be more aware of the legality and the can of worms that's going to be created here.
Is there anybody here who would like to speak to this? I'm glad to see Mr. Anderson. I think I do want to hear from retailers and
thank you, Madam Chair and
what
committee.
Effect this would have. Thank you, Mr. Riker.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Buzz Anderson, President of the Minnesota Retailers. Thank you for the opportunity to speak, and thanks for Senator Olson for visiting with me a couple of minutes before the committee. I want to start by saying that, you know, if you're a retailer in today's retail world, you have a choice about whether or not you want to accept checks. In fact, fewer and fewer retailers are accepting checks. There's a great deal of dismay for me about that because I write checks for a lot of stuff. But besides that, a retailer has no choice about whether or not to accept credit cards or debit cards. That's just a fact. If you're going to be in business, you have to accept them. Part of that acceptance is you get a contract from Visa and MasterCard, which is as thick as the St. Paul phone book. And I can assure you that nobody has read it because it's just so complicated you couldn't understand it. Probably most lawyers, with all due respect, would have trouble understanding it. It's incredibly complex. Now, there's real interesting parts about that contract. One is it says you can't keep the PIN numbers, you can't keep the security code numbers, and you can't keep all the information on the back of the magnetic strip, exactly what this bill says. So, you know, Visa and MasterCard do audit this. There are a number of companies, retailers, that are actually trying to get what's called PCI certification, where they actually have to go through a real extensive process to get this process approval by Visa and MasterCard. Plus, they have to go through a private audit by specific auditing firms to make sure that they've complied with everything in the contract. So it's a very, very cumbersome process. Probably most small retailers aren't even aware of that. Having said that, these companies, Visa, MasterCard, are continuing to clamp down more and more about what can and cannot be done. And I want to tell you something interesting that happened to one of my members, a relatively large but family-owned retailer here in Minnesota, which started in the 1880s. About 4 or 5 years ago, because of all the concerns about security breaches, they decided that they would encrypt all of the information they keep about customers. The only information they keep is the credit card number and the person's name. And they keep it for a year, and they hired a company to garner that information and encrypt it for them. And they keep that because a person might want to return something, so they got to make a credit on the person's credit card account, or there may have been actually an identity theft issue where they've got to, again, use that credit card number and the person's name to resolve whatever problem there is with that card. But when they went through this process voluntarily to have this information encrypted, somebody within that encrypting company stole 40 credit card numbers. Once Visa and MasterCard found out, they notified them, and 2 weeks later they were told they would be fined $400,000 by Visa and MasterCard. It's in the contract. It's not adjudicated. There was no hearing. They just said, next Tuesday we're deducting $400,000 from your account. And so it was then upon them to go to the people who they'd hired to do the encrypting to sue them. They went back to their insurance company and they said, yes, you have security breach insurance, but it isn't covered under this circumstance. So they're in a bunch of legal maneuvers just to try to get all through that. My point is, this is a very, very complicated process. So no matter how hard you try, you can't possibly anticipate every situation. Now, having said all that, We are subject to the contract agreements by Visa and MasterCard that doesn't let us keep any of this stuff. And so we're, first of all, even asking, why is the bill necessary? Now, we keep hearing about TJ Maxx. I've tried to find out information about what happened to TJ Maxx. Nobody knows. Nobody knows what information they kept. Nobody knows what information was compromised. It's being investigated by the FBI, by the Secret Service, the Department of Justice. Nobody knows what happened. So we've got a bill here based on what happened to TJ Maxx, and yet nobody knows what really happened. Another one of our concerns is that, and Senator Olson made reference to this, when in fact you do a debit transaction at a store, people put in their PIN number. Now, the retailer has that PIN number, and they have the PIN number for as long as it takes the transaction to be cleared. I've been calling for a month, and I actually talked to somebody from Visa this morning, and they told me that, yes, it takes 24 to 48 hours for that whole transaction to be completed. So I want to make sure that if this bill continues to move, and Senator Olson said she would, this is not her intent, but if the bill continues to move, if, in fact, they have to hold on to that information for 24 to 48 hours. They're not in violation of a statute which says they can't hold that information, because they do have to hold it until the transaction is completed. They're notified by the credit card company that's the case. The last part is the penalty section. We're concerned about any time there's a private right of action or a potential class action against a company. A lot of retailers are small, and they literally have a salesperson coming in once a week to offer them a new credit card processing and cheaper credit card processing system. As Senator Olson, Senator Johnson said, it's usually 1.5% to 3%, but they come by and say, oh, we'll do 1.2%, we'll do 1.9%. So they're usually switching because they want to try to get a lower rate. They don't necessarily always know what's in the program that they have, the software that they buy. And again, they don't have, they're small businesses, they don't have the expertise to know that. So my point is, and to Senator Johnson's point, you're probably going to put some small businesses at risk who aren't knowingly keeping this information. It's not their intent. They're not allowed by their contract to keep it, but they might be doing it accidentally. So, you know, you might want to consider saying that a company that knowingly does this would be in violation, because nobody would knowingly keep this information. There's no reason for them to have it. They really don't need it. The last thing is, not only do companies, retailers pay like the 1.2% to 3% for the credit card transaction, they also pay an interchange fee by credit card companies. It's not negotiable. We get a notice every year that says, okay, your interchange rate's going up. Part of the reason for the interchange fee is to pay all the costs and remedies talked about in this bill, to pay back financial institutions and whoever who end up having a security breach as a result of carelessness on part of a retailer. So it's always been our understanding that if there's a breach, we're going to get fined, or we pay the interchange fee exactly for that reason. Now, I've talked to some of the financial institutions, the credit credit unions, I'm sorry, and they told me they've never been paid. It might be better to even have a bill that says, if that's what credit card companies are collecting the interchange fee for, then maybe they are the ones that should be reimbursing the financial institutions or the credit card companies. So I would also just like to say to the credit unions, they've been working with us to try to change this language. It's still not exactly where we want it, but they've been working with us, and I want to acknowledge that. And I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Okay. I think what I'm understanding, Senator Olson, is that we're shifting the burden here. The consumer pays, but on the other hand, a retailer strikes me could be put out of business if something happens here, which is different than all consumers bearing the cost here. Yeah.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure I would say that we're shifting the burden the consumer pays, because right now the responsibility is on the bank or the credit union issuing the credit card. And there's a responsibility that the retailer has not to keep this information. And I just have to say, again, I'm not certain, and I'm not specifically pointing fingers at to say that I know this is happening, but I do know that larger businesses use personal information for marketing targeting. And sometimes it's sold. Sometimes it's to determine creditworthiness. They use private information in ways that probably would surprise a lot of consumers. And I think we have to be concerned that companies or retailers or anyone who's holding private, sensitive financial information is doing it in a responsible way. And basically all this is saying is when they're not handling this information in a responsible way that's putting the financial information of a consumer at risk, that they are going to share or they are going to bear that financial responsibility. Whether they insure for it, they certainly have that option. Or whether if they're going to be responsible for hiring a reputable company that handles this in a reputable way, that's their option. But to say that we're just going to put this responsibility and continue to put this responsibility on companies that aren't controlling how the information is being handled is really unfairly shifting the risk to the credit card companies, which is then passed along to the consumer. And so I certainly don't have a problem with amending this so that there's a 48-hour window to allow them to processed information, and that's something that if it had been raised to me earlier, I would have already had an amendment prepared. And I also understand that this engrossment of the bill eliminated the Attorney General provision, which honestly I didn't mind that provision, but I think that was to make it comply with something that was done in the other body so that there would be less of a concern about a class action lawsuit or something like that, so that the bill as it stands is much more of a compromise than as it was originally introduced. So, again, I'm not sure how the members of this committee feel, but I know that the intent of this bill is to reduce fraud to help protect the private nature of very sensitive financial information, and I believe that will benefit consumers overall.
Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson alluded to they can insure themselves against this. There isn't a specific kind of insurance vehicle or policy type that will cover this.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Senator Johnson, I mean, insurance can be written to cover anything between a private party and an insurance company that the two parties decide to cover. And so it's, you know, if there hasn't been a risk to insure in the past, then there isn't going to be a policy that addresses that risk. In a situation where the risk is statutorily changed, then you certainly can write an insurance policy to cover anything that you would want. If there's a need, there's going to be a market for it, I would think. But the fact is, usually, in general, under the law, the risk, the cost of bearing something is borne by the party that causes the harm or causes the risk. And in this situation, we have the cost being borne by a party that doesn't have any control over what's happening with this data and this information.
Yes, Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, members, generally speaking, Senator Johnson, I think you were gone when I mentioned that one of my members was fined $400,000 because a company they actually hired to encrypt their credit card information was misused by that company, and their insurance company, they had identity theft insurance, and it didn't cover that. So now they're actually in court over that. But another point I wanted to make is not only are we not able to collect to keep this information by our contracts with Visa and MasterCard, but in addition to that, I field a lot of calls from people that aren't even members that want to have questions about retail. And somebody called one day and asked me, this was a couple of years ago, you know what, I keep people's credit card numbers and their name for the reason that I had talked about earlier. And they said, is it possible for me to take that name and that number and kind of try to match it up with people in the phone book So I can maybe write them a letter and say they should come back to my store. I said it's against the federal government law to do that. You cannot use credit card information for marketing purposes under federal law. So it's pretty regulated in terms of how you can use that information. So companies may at one time have misused that information. I doubt if they do it anymore because I think penalties are pretty severe if they would even attempt to do that.
Senator Olson, I guess my point was that consumers pay the price currently under the system we have, whether it's higher interest rates in your credit cards or higher cost of goods and services. But what you're asking for is a shift, I guess, a shift in the burden of who, and I worry that a small retailer in particular, of which most are, could be put out of business, whereas the bank, the credit union, or whatever, is in a better position to deal with the problem. I mean, that my concern here is that balance. And Senator Marty, you have...
Madam Chair, I'm not quite sure what I'm hearing, though, is I think Senator Johnson and Mr. Anderson both commented on the fact they have to do this contractually already, but it's really complicated. I can't picture even small retailers signing contracts that they have no intention of complying with. And if that's the case, I know Mr. Anderson said, well, we don't need this because it's already required. Well, we can make the other case. If it's already required because of the contracts, then they should be complying with this. So I'm kind of puzzled by that because I'm hearing you say that, well, it's really complicated stuff, and even though we're contractually required to get rid of it, we're not. Mm-hmm. And therefore, this bill will cause us to go out of business and everything else. I think the other question might be, does it do much? Because if they're already required to, but obviously some people aren't keeping with the contracts.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you to Senator Marty. The retailer is already complying to the best of his ability and knowledge to the contract. He's storing the information, he's deleting the information, and he's trying to keep it out of other people's hands. But the problem is because it is an internet piece of information, and there was a comment earlier about that when the consumer goes to the retailer and uses the card, that's the point at which the information is held, and that's not true. It's on the internet. The card, Visa and MasterCard immediately have that information. The breaches are coming in from outside of the retailer's position. The breaches are happening with a bad employee or a stranger or a breach into their computer systems. It's not happening with the retailer. They're doing everything in their capability and knowledge to secure the information contractually.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, then if they are deleting the PIN number stuff, it's not the credit card, but the PIN number information, the security code, whatever that thing is on the back of there, and the other information, if they are deleting that, if they're doing everything possible, I'm not sure what...
Hackers. Madam Chair, hackers.
Madam Chair, for $50 you can buy a thing that does go through and will do Defense Department level of clearing your computer. I mean, you can buy the kind that they'll go one swipe through to wipe it all off a second time, or you can have it do, the program I have, it'll do it seven times, which is Department of Defense standard. You can do those things. It's not like hackers can get past that. I'm not sure what I'm missing there, because if they are complying with this, and I don't know, maybe they are eliminating it from their computers and they're making a good faith effort. Maybe it's not the seven times pass through and so on, but they're getting rid of it, and somebody comes in and hacks it, or an employee does something wrong, there's nothing for them to hack or get the employee data out. At least I'm missing what you're...
Well, I think, Senator Marty, what Senator Johnson is saying is once, I think it goes on, I don't know if it's onto your hard drive, it's there.
It's internal.
And you can't...
You can get rid of it, though. There are programs to do that. Defense Department. When your comment about you couldn't sell the computers, Madam Chair, you can't sell the computers, you can you can get that all off of there. It's not easy to do, but you can do it. You can buy the programs who do it to Defense Department standards. And Defense Department, I don't know, maybe our Defense
well,
Department...
Well, Senator Martin, you might be overrating that.
I'm not going to say that you're not.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Again, I think Senator Marty's point was simply that in this situation, this is something that's already being required. It's only going to impact people who are not complying or retailers who are not complying with existing agreements. And I agree. The reason I'm concerned about it isn't to protect, honestly, you know, the large credit card companies versus the large retailers. And I'm also concerned about small merchants and small businesses, but we also have small credit card, or not credit card companies, but small banks and small credit unions that also can't afford to absorb financial losses, potential financial losses that could amount to a lot of money. So I guess the question in my mind again comes back to fairness. Is it more fair to put the responsibility on the organization that has the ability to do something about this, which they're already supposed to be doing? And is this something we can do to prevent these losses in the future and to protect consumers from having their financial information misused and going through all of the headaches associated with these kinds of breaches when the information is not stored appropriately? So it's what it comes down to.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, members, Senator Olson, there is no retailer that would knowingly keep this information. They might have inadequate software. They might have old equipment. I guess my point is this is really, really complicated. But nobody's going to keep this information intentionally. That's why I mentioned the issue about if you knowingly do this, if you knowingly keep this information to the intent to defraud the customer, that's one thing. I might also say, too, that larger financial institutions actually have better security systems than credit unions, too. They make bigger investments, too. And perhaps credit card companies or credit unions can't afford to do that, what the larger financial institutions do. Senator Marty, to your point, if you decide to go in business, you know, many businesses are jacks of all trades and masters of none. You have to be a generalist. You have to know a lot of things. And when you get that contract from Visa and MasterCard, it is a St. Paul phone book in thickness, and you cannot decipher what it all says. But your choice is sign it or you don't do Visa MasterCard. And if you don't do Visa or MasterCard, you can't do business.
See the light.
We have like 2 minutes left. There are people here I know for a bill that I have. I want to, and I think some people have come from out of town.
Madam Chair, I think there was someone else from the grocery industry, excuse me, that wanted to.
Yes,
Madam
Chair. No, I'm just wanting to tell them, if they're looking at the clock and wondering what we're going to do, I'm going to have to ask them in the matter of my bill, which is Senate File 1532, to put something in writing that I will make sure every committee member has, because I'm clearly not going to get to it right now. During this meeting.
Madam Chair, could
yes,
I make
Senator
a suggestion? I don't know if we would have time to revisit this bill very briefly, but I'm just thinking that I wonder if we couldn't put some language in here that would not make this an absolute, but would make it more of a they have to take reasonable steps, something that would, again, not be like strict liability, but would put a burden on them to take things to take reasonable precautions, because I do think we want to promote some responsibility, at least in my opinion we do, that would be protective of consumers, but we want to do it in a fair way.
Senator Olson, your bill has to go to judiciary as well, I think.
And another possibility
and
is,
sure
I guess,
what we're all going to do about these bills.
Is if this committee takes is comfortable, that is certainly something I would work with retail before getting to judiciary to put some language in here that makes it less of a strict liability standard so that people are not going to unknowingly fail to comply with the law in this respect.
I'm going to ask if there's anybody else that wants to speak to it, and let's see where we go with that, Senator Olson. Well, welcome.
Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Jamie Poole, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Grocers Association. We mirror many of the retailers' sentiments, so I will keep this very brief. The security breach is a horrendous priority for the grocers. We are working very diligently to self-manage through the PCI standards. Those are a set of rules being implemented by a coalition of Visa, MasterCard, American Express, and Discover. They're detailed rules that are put in place, and we are proactively working to eliminate all potential security breaches. What I think it's important that you know is that retailers are fined when there is a security breach. I do know in hearing, there was a release this morning that one of my members had that said TJ Maxx has already paid $5 million in fines because of the security breach that they experienced. And this money is, from what we understand, supposed to go to the banks and the credit unions to support the cost. This is coming from the retailer. We also pay an interchange fee, and according to our agreements, parts of this are to be set up as an insurance to for any of these security breaches that happen. The way we see it is this piece of legislation sets up the potential for actually additional fines to the retailers, so they are experiencing the burdens on many different levels. They are paying money if there is a security breach that does get back to the banks and to support this. Our biggest goal is that we ask you just to slow this piece of legislation down so that we can make sure that we're not putting an undue burden on the retailers and that we are making something that will work best for everyone. Thank you.
Ms. Poole, thank you. Senator Olson, if we don't pass it on right now, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen to my bill as well. I don't know if it's snowing or not. Maybe we will meet tonight.
Well, Madam Chair, again, I understand the concern with wanting to deal with things committee by committee, but because of the time constraints, if this committee is comfortable, there are a couple of different things that have been raised to me just before and at this hearing that have to do with strict liability, which I'm very happy, you know, to work on that language. The time period of 48 hours, and there was another thing I can't remember what it was as it was raised. Oh, penalties. It seems to me that it would be very easy to put language in the bill to make sure that there isn't that it doesn't provide for double penalties, so that any penalties in the bill would only be available if those particular costs had not already been reimbursed under the private contract that there might have been between the credit card company and the retailer. And I think it would be easy to continue the spirit of the bill and continue with the consumer protection that this bill is intended to address and just clean that up a little bit, so with amendments that we could introduce in judiciary if that satisfies this committee.
Members, do you have a feeling about this? Senator Scogin.
I certainly thank you, Madam Chair. I certainly feel for Senator Olson, but at times I feel sometimes we're willing to move things along, hoping someone will clean it up someplace else, and it doesn't always happen. So I'm a little hesitant to.
Well, sure.
Senator
Scogin is right on. We're here to do our job on these issues, and the Judicial Committee does some other stuff, mm-hmm. the penalties and what have you. So I agree with you. I think we ought to do it right here.
I'm getting the weather forecast. Not starting till 7 o'clock.
Not what you wanted to hear.
Now we can work.
Well, we can come back, members. Senator Olson, I'm not comfortable sending it on this way. It seems to me you've got a challenge here because I know you're on the Judiciary Committee. I don't know if you have a bill in front of them today. But I know you have that that's a time constraint as well.
Right. And, Madam Chair, I'm happy to go along with whatever the wishes of the committee are, not that it's my choice anyway, but
right.
However you'd like me to approach this, I will work with the stakeholders here and address what I feel are the three areas that could use some, just based on the discussion we've had here, could use some amendment.
So then I think, I don't know if we need a motion to lay it over. Senator Metzen would so move.
Yeah,
and members, are you able to be here this evening?
Sure.
No, just let's work.
Well, we have a committee coming in here, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Madam Chair.
At 3. That's my problem.
Environment again tonight at 6 across the hall. So
there's no other date.
Senator
Pretner
Solon.
And, Madam Chair, the Energy Committee also is meeting, and I don't know that we'll be finished at 5:30. We will be just going on until. And there are three members from here on that committee also.
Yeah, we did have the time set aside, I think, for 6 o'clock tonight.
Nothing tomorrow or the next day.
It does sound like most of the members of the committee are going to be in the building anyhow.
Yeah.
That's it. You could recess.
Elvis.
That way you...
Elvis is
Yeah, I think that what we're going to do, I think we'll try to come back here at 6. I did have that on the schedule, I believe. It's there. We will recess until 6, and we will try to finish our agenda this evening so that... and that includes then, is that three more bills at Senator Scogin?
Four more.
Sparky.
Senator Sparks has two bills, and I have a bill. So that's 5 bills for this evening.
My testifier can be here tonight.
Okay, that's good.
Not all.
Okay, so with that, members, the Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee will recess until 6 o'clock, and I believe we're in this room at 6. Is that right? Okay. So we're recessed.